We referred to him on our rundown here tonight at the FDHLounge.com as one of the greatest pitchers of the last 50 years, and I think that is undeniably true. It's our immense pleasure tonight on the FDH Lounge to welcome in the one and only Tommy John. Tommy, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you guys? I thought, you know, when you were talking about that, I thought you were talking about Herb Gore from behind.
You know what? That's really interesting you mentioned Herb Score, because one of the things that I was going to note here is there's a lot of what-ifs. I look at where you started your career with my hometown Cleveland Indians. Boy, I mean, if Herb Score doesn't get beaned, if we don't stupidly ship you out of town, if Sudden Sam doesn't have his problems, if we hang on to Chris Chambliss, those Indians of the 1960s, I mean, Tommy, the what-ifs are just right on down the line, aren't they? Tommy?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, we seem to be having a little bit of technical difficulties here, but I can hear you, I think. The Indians of the 1960s, my hometown team, we shipped you out of here very unfortunately, but a lot of what-ifs there, are there not? When you Herb Score, Sudden Sam, we traded Chris Chambliss the same decade, of course, Kyle Avito. I mean, that team, if we could have kept you guys together and people didn't have their various maladies that they had, that could have been something.
Well, you know, Hoot Evers signed, or well, actually, Bob Kennedy signed me, and Hoot Evers signed Tommy Agee almost on the same day. Hoot was down in Mobile signing Agee, and I was up in Cleveland getting signed by Gabe Paul and Bob Kennedy. You know, so you had Agee, myself, Sam McDowell, Sonny Siebert, Steve Hargan. You had quite a bit of pitching, and for whatever reason, back in that time, Cleveland could never figure out if they wanted to be a pitching-oriented ball club or a hitting-oriented ball club. One year you would come in, the fences would be back to 400 feet in left and right center, and the next year you would come in and they'd be 350. And it just seemed like they could never figure out what they wanted to do. And but, you know, we've always had. When I signed with Cleveland in 61, in June of 61, we had Barry Lapman, Mudcat Grant, Jim Perry, Jack Kralik, Dick Donovan. You know, I mean, we had so many guys in there that were pitching rich. God, they had good arms. Oh, just, I think we led the league in strikeouts like every year.
What an unbelievable staff that was, absolutely. You know, and you look at the possibilities of the day, it's very interesting. You mentioned that about the going back and forth on the direction of the club, because right about at the time of the end of your major league career, I remember this, that when Alex Cole came up and was a centerpiece player for the team, it just shows you what a cipher that ballpark was. You know, you could really do anything you wanted with it. Alex Cole comes onto the team, and the next thing you know, they're configuring the team to be built around speed. You know, you really could do anything you wanted with that cavernous type of yard and the dimensions they had. But it was something that was peculiar to one of the old style type stadiums of that nature, the way that the old cavernous municipal stadium was. It's very interesting to me in looking at your career subsequently. In some cases, it was on the periphery. Maybe in some cases, it was the second biggest team in a market, like the White Sox or the Angels. But after you left Cleveland, for all intents and purposes, you never really played in another minor market again the rest of your career. That was a heck of a swing to be playing in major markets that whole time. Tommy, we got you there? All right, we are having what looks to be some technical
difficulties. Yeah, I'm right here.
Oh, okay.
I'm right here.
I'm sorry. We must be cutting in and out with our ability to hear one another. But as far as it goes with your career post-Cleveland, very interesting. Again, the White Sox and the Angels, the second biggest teams in the local markets in terms of popularity. But you never, for all intents and purposes, played in a minor market again after you left Cleveland. What was that like to consistently be playing in the big cities, Chicago, New York, and L.A., with the exception of Oakland briefly, for the rest of your career?
Well, Chicago was fun because that was like home. I was 3 hours from home. My mom and dad could get up and see me. my friends could get up and see me. And then I was traded to the Dodgers. And that was my first exposure to really big-time media market. All the newspapers and everybody, and the Dodgers were so PR-oriented that I've never seen anything like it. They really controlled the press. They did a great job with the press. And it was fun going out there playing with the Dodgers. And a bad night would be 30,000 in the ballpark. It was just a horrible night. And usually at the end of the season, the Dodgers would be averaging about 40,000 a game. That's great. And then I went to the Yankees, and truth be known, up until 87, 88, the Yankees didn't draw. I think the most that they ever drew was like 1.8 million was their biggest. And then all of a sudden they started breaking that 2 million barrier, and then it was 2.2, 2.3, 2.5, 2.8. Now routinely it's 3.5 million fans troop through the gates at Yankee Stadium. But it's fun. It's fun playing before big crowds, and we're all actors, and I know my son Taylor was in the play Les Miserables, and the people that were in the tour with him said that it's much more fun to go out there and act when you have a loud, enthusiastic crowd, and that's the same way that it is in baseball.
Well, that's true. I can imagine that with the dynamics of the crowd and everything that you're dealing with. Something that's kind of interesting to me as I was looking and I was getting ready for the interview tonight, the only other comparison that I can make with you in a certain sense of what I'm about to talk about here would be John Madden, as far as sort of being a Rorschach test for people. What do you think of when you hear the name? For somebody like me still, I think of the totality of your career and Tommy John, everything he did over time. To people past my age, pretty much, somebody hears Tommy John, and you're more so associated with being the first guy to have survived that type of big arm surgery and come back and really made it from that. I mean, in 100 years from now, people will be talking about guys having Tommy John surgery. So for something like that, how do you reflect upon that, upon being known really for different things by different people? And I guess it sort of depends on how old you are.
Well, it's I have that question asked all the time, and the thing about it is, I'm going to be known probably more for Tommy John surgery than for 288 wins or 26 seasons or 46 shutouts or whatever I did. I'm probably going to be known more for the surgery than anything else.
It's really notable for you to be known for that, because again, your comeback from that really was regarded as miraculous, and it was something where we've heard various things over time where you always hear, okay, it's maybe going to take a year for somebody to come back, and you think that you hear that, okay, this guy might be 90% for a while even after he's back. But we've heard instances in recent years anyways of guys supposedly having a little bit of extra zip, extra velocity as time goes by after the surgery. Does that seem plausible to you based on your experiences?
Well, I don't know how hard I threw before the surgery, because we never had radar guns. I pitched in a ball game 1 year, one day after surgery. And, that's about what it is now. And it wasn't until, about halfway through the 76 season that I really started to figure out what I had to do to pitch well if I didn't have my good stuff. And that's the whole thing about pitching. Pitching is, anybody can pitch if you've got your A game. But it's being able to pitch when you're 5, 6, 7 innings when you've got nothing. That's the true artistry of a pitcher. And, it wasn't until about halfway through that 76 season that I started to feel that.
Oh, I can understand where that would be the case. Yeah, it'd probably take you a while to get used to it and start to make your adjustments again. You mentioned the 288 wins before, and I realize it's a double-edged sword, even in a positive context, for me here to endorse your Hall of Fame credentials, which I'm about to do. But again, I look at this, and you know, 288 wins, as you mentioned, 334 ERA, and it almost seems like, in terms of the votes that haven't gone your way, as though I see also your contemporary Nolan Ryan, where that argument is used against him, prolonged period of excellence as opposed to, you know, some of the stat nerds want to see somebody average, you know, 26 wins, 4 losses over a 5-year period or that kind of stuff. But, I mean, my God, you spanned, you know, really the Kennedy administration to the first George Bush administration. I mean, that kind of longevity alone and the all-star appearances and everything like that, just – you know, for whatever it's worth, and we don't have a vote, but, you know, I certainly would call it a Travis Sham mockery, and I would look for the Veterans Committee, I think, to address that at its earliest opportunity.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I'm through with the sports writers. I've had my 15 years on there, and fell many votes shy, and I think when I get in, the veterans will vote me in, and... you know, truth be known, I would really feel better if my peers vote me in than guys that never saw me pitch. I mean, most of the sports writers that are voting never saw Tommy John pitch, so they can only go on what they see and in statistics, and that doesn't tell you exactly how I pitched. You know, I was not a strikeout pitcher, that I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. But I could pitch the big games, about as well as anybody around. And I relish the fact that I could pitch those games. I love pitching the Peters and the Carltons and the Marischals and the guys like that. That was fun. But, you know, it's just it's what it is. And we'll just...
That's a great point. I think your peers are way more qualified to vote on you than the sports writers would be. I hadn't even thought about that, but yeah, you know, sports writers turn over. The Veterans Committee really doesn't. The Veterans Committee is and it only continues to be augmented probably by guys who you played against. That's an excellent point there. But you know, it really. You mentioned at a certain point in the 76 season when you felt like things were starting to come back together. Is it safe to say it was that same season, which was, of course, a comeback of the year season for you when you won that award? Would you say that season that you were back as good as you would be for the rest of your prime, or would you say it might have taken into 77 or maybe even 78 to get back to that level?
No, it would have gone into the last half of 76. I was throwing the ball about as well as I could. And then 77, 78, Tommy Lasorda was my manager. And for whatever reason, Walt Alston didn't think I could go much past 6 innings. And so I would go my 6 innings. He would have the bullpen up, and I'd be gone. And Lasorda came in, and he just looked at me and he said, "You want to pitch?" "Yeah, I want to pitch." "Well, go on out there and get the job done." And when you have somebody that shows confidence in you like that, it's a whole lot easier to get to pitch and pitch effectively than knowing that you got a manager there that's ready to pull the ripcord as soon as you get a batter on in the seventh inning.
Well, speaking of Tommy, I'm sorry, you mentioned Walt Alston. I was thinking of that the next year you would be managed by Tommy Lasorda. We'd had him on the show last fall on the eve of the National League Championship Series. I found it very noteworthy in terms of his candor. I asked him, I kind of put him on the spot about Clayton Kershaw. You know, how much are you going to be leaning on this guy? Is it going to have to be like it was with Josh Beckett for Florida in 2003 when he has to take this precocious step forward? And maybe it's a little easier to do this when you're not the manager, but he pretty much went with what I said and said, "Yeah, you know, we're really counting on this young guy. And I know he's young," but, you know, that was basically the thrust of his answer. And I just was like, wow, I can't believe the candor of this guy. You know, he didn't try to dance away from it or sugarcoat it in any way or say, oh, we don't want to heap any pressure on this kid. That just shows me right there that Tommy had to be a very unique guy to play for.
Unique was a good word. Tommy was great. You know, the thing about Tommy is when he came in, he had a lot of, he started bringing back a lot of the Hollywood stars. You know, you go in and you see Jonathan Winters and Don Rickles and Sinatra and guys like that in the clubhouse all the time. And, you know, and that was the fun thing about Tommy. He enjoyed having those people around, and it was fun. It was fun playing the game, having them around. I remember one game in Los Angeles. I'm walking out to my car on a Sunday afternoon, and I hear this, "Tommy, Tommy, oh Tommy!" And I turn around and I go, "Holy crap! Here comes Cary Grant following me, waving his arms at me." And we stood out in the parking lot a lot and talked about an hour about pitching and parenting and living in L.A. and living in New York and things like that. And I said, where but only with the Dodgers could you be out there and have Cary Grant chasing you down in the Players' parking lot?
That is amazing, you know, when you look at that. And I look
it's kind of like it's kind of like having Dorothy Fullheim chasing you down at Municipal Stadium after a ball game.
Yeah, well, see, and that she would have been a little closer to her prime when that happened. I only remember the tail end of her career, but yeah, I mean, boy, that would have, she might have been able to maneuver around back in the early '60s, huh?
You know, when I was at Cleveland, the guy that was her nemesis on TV was Gullardi, Ernie Anderson. You remember him?
Yeah.
Friday night, Fright Night, and oh God, I tell you, that brings back a ton of memories right there.
Oh my God! Oh yeah, there's you must have a bunch of them from Cleveland's a very colorful city, as you well know. But you know, it's speaking of colorful, you know, we talked about Lasorda, but I mean, you really played for some and for as many great teams as you were on. I guess it's not a surprise. So many great managers. Lasorda, you mentioned Alston, Billy Martin. I'm looking at the timeline of when you were with the Angels, and I'm thinking Gene Mock was probably there at one point when you were there. I mean, you had a bunch of them, Tommy.
Well, yeah, I did. And, you know, people ask me who were the great managers. You know, all managers had their good points, and a lot of them had their bad points. Lasorda was probably the best motivator I ever played for. Al Lopez was probably one of the best managers, he and Dick Houser. Eddie Stanky was the best fundamentalist. Probably he and Gene Mock were in that same mold of being able to, you know, really, really working on the fundamentals part of the game. And Eddie Stanky probably taught me more about pitching. For somebody that didn't know anything about pitching, and I try and get guys to do it when I was in the Expo organization, and that is starting pitchers the night they pitch or the next day, have them come in and have them go over the game, not so much pitch by pitch, but what the first hitter do, what was the count, what was the pitch, what did he do? And the reason Eddie had me do that is he said you can't pitch to them in the third and fourth time at bat if you don't know what you did to them in the first and second time at bat. And I really believe that's one of the reasons why these guys today can't pitch deep into the ball game, because they have no idea what they did for those first times at bat.
That's a very good point, because you know, they have to be familiar with you know, the patterns here in order to be able to really improve themselves. As far as the philosophy of pitching, I've got a quote from a book here that Bill Madden and Moss Klein wrote called Damned Yankees. I mention this quote, Tommy, purely because I'm a sucker for colorful quotes in any walk of life. And this is a quote that sort of sums up the cynicism of folks when they look at aging pitchers who are hanging on. And you really battled with guts and guile for a long time there, particularly your final years in New York, hanging on in the major leagues as you did. there's a quote here, and it's kind of a cynical one, but a funny one. I just want to get your reaction to it, and it might very well be outrage for all I know, but here's the quote. This was from a scout. Quote, Tommy John against Don Sutton. If anyone can find one smooth ball from that game, he ought to send it to Cooperstown, end quote. So when you hear that kind of cynicism, what kind of goes through your mind?
Well, here's the thing. We were accused of a lot of stuff. And if I did everything that I was supposed to do to a baseball, I would have to have a carpenter's belt on my waist to go out there. All I know is every time the umpires checked a baseball, every time they checked me or whatever, I was clean. So I don't know what was supposed to be done or what was ever going on, but, you know, that is what it is. And, like I said, I was checked numerous times, and I was found to be clean and green.
I hear you. You know, that's a perfect answer to give. You know, just look at the record, and they don't have anything on me. That's
I never got suspended. I never got thrown out of a game. I never got anything like that, and it was funny. Every time a ball got marked or whatever in the opposing, it was always in the opposing team's dugout. Never was a ball marked up that an umpire came out and I threw him a ball and he looked at it and said, hey, wait a minute, this ball's got whatever on it. Not for me.
Yeah.
You know, so you hear this, and I just say, you know, for 231 losses, I couldn't have been doing a whole lot of stuff because I lost 231 times.
That's true, yeah. You could have cut that number in half if you were really determined to scuff. So.
It's like they're saying, well, one of the reasons that you're having a lot of no-hitters this year, and I've been on a couple radio shows, and people are saying, well, it's because of the steroids. The hitters are not on the juice anymore, and, you know, if you throw a spitter or cut a fastball or whatever, you still have to throw a strike with it. You still have to throw a good strike with it. Taking steroids doesn't make you a good hitter. It just makes you a strong hitter. You have to be a good hitter starting out before steroids will ever help you. And I just get tired of hearing people think that all you got to do is take the juice and all of a sudden you're going to be a 300 hitter and you're going to bang home runs. When I was on my game, I was hoping that everybody in the lineup was on steroids because I could get a lot of hard 6-3 ground balls, you know, I think it's an easy out for a lot of people. I do. I think it's a very easy out.
I think you're clearly right about that. It's a thing where steroids, HGH, these other things can augment an existing skill set. But yeah, you don't go from zero to superstar. You know, you're building on whatever you already have with that. That's an excellent point. What I'm curious about from your perspective, I think you mentioned previously with the Expos organization, I know also with managing the Bridgeport Bluefish as you did for a while, from having been on the instructional side of the game as you've been, I want to put this question to you as I do to any of the guests recently when we're talking baseball. It's our theory here at FDH that the number of aces in baseball, and we can quibble about the definition of that and who makes it and who doesn't, but roughly it's gone from, I'd say, 10 to about 25 in the last 2 to 3 years, that there seem to be a lot more legitimate aces coming into the game right now. You really haven't seen too many of the guys who are at that level in the last 2 to 3 years slip off of there. So first and foremost, do you agree with that supposition? And if you do, is there anything you would attribute that to other than the cyclical nature of position dominance? Tommy, I think we might have – we've had a couple of snags, unfortunately, here in our connection here tonight. So, basically –
Okay. Now you're back.
Gotcha. All right, Tommy, we got you there. Just wanted to ask you, again, you've obviously spent some time on the instructional side of baseball, managing and coaching. And, again, from that perspective, and as well as from broadcasting as well, would you agree with our supposition here at FDH that in the last 2 to 3 years you've seen the number of legitimate ace pitchers in baseball go from roughly 10 to about roughly 25? And Do you agree with that? And if so, is there anything that you would attribute that to other than the cyclical nature of position dominance?
Well, I think the big thing is there's a lot more power arms in the game now. They may not be able to throw strikes all the time or whatever, but there's a lot of power arms, and that's all that they're scouting. God, if I had to play the game in this era, I don't think I could have made it, because I never threw hard. Even when I was in high school, I did not throw hard. Cleveland signed me. They signed me on my curveball, and that would never happen now. You could never sign anybody on their curveball. It's got to be off their fastball. So all of a sudden, you've got somebody like Tommy John that is 288 wins that you've lost because I never threw 95 miles an hour. And, I think that's one of the part of the game that what I would like to see them do, and I've said this all along, is I would like to see them bring back the success ratio into the game. If you're successful, you're good. If you're not successful, you aren't. And I don't care how hard you throw. And I just think that if you go back to that, you would have a lot more quality pitchers in the same league than the guys who are behind.
We're just about losing you there. Our connection has kind of waned, kind of come and gone through the course of the night. Can you hear me at this point?
Hello.
Oh, Tommy. Okay, good. You're back. We had lost you for a second there. I wanted to, because we always want to give our guests a chance to plug on this show. We have a link up at our rundown at the FDHLounge.com tonight to sportablescoreboards.com. I know that has been a lot of the primary focus of your professional work recently. So by all means, Tommy, please take an opportunity, talk about that and any other projects you're working on professionally here or personally at the moment.
Well, I was managing in an independent league up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and I resigned last year to take a job as regional sales manager for Sportable Scoreboard. So I'm selling baseball, football, basketball, hockey, soccer, lacrosse scoreboards, and we're out of Murray, Kentucky, and I'm the regional sales manager, and I'm in Arlington, Texas, and I'm kind of 2 miles from Ranger Stadium and about 2.5 miles from Jerry Jones World. So, I can come home at night and I look and I see the lights of Ranger Stadium on and all that. But, if anybody out there is, wants, scoreboards, for their little league, parks and rec, or high school, or whatever, football, like I said, football, basketball, baseball, get in touch with me. I would be happy. And then what I do is, if you buy the scoreboards from me, usually I come in and put a clinic on, a pitching clinic or whatever, as a little thank you for the people that buy the boards from me.
Well, we have a link up to sportablescoreboards.com. Is that the best way for people to reach you, through the website?
Yeah, that's the best way. And go to the 800 number, and when you get to the 800 number, dial my extension, which is 288. And the reason they gave me 288 is that's how many wins I had. And I would love to work with people, and especially little leagues and parks and rec. And it's fun going out and seeing these scoreboards go in. And it's something to keep me busy, at least until I call it quits. And I don't know when that's going to be, but another couple years, and then I'll retire and maybe retire to Arizona and go watch spring training baseball and watch the Diamondbacks and watch the Arizona Cardinals and all that, and then also watch my beloved Chicago Bears play too.
I can't even imagine when you're going out and you're putting the scoreboards in and you're doing the clinics. That must be a big thrill for everybody to get to have you do that for them. Tommy, it was a tremendous thrill for us to have you on the program here tonight. Love to have you back sometime here. We'll definitely promote Sportable Scoreboards some more with you and talk about these things. And thank you so much for sharing about your wonderful career with us, and we'd love to do it again, sir.
I tell you, I would be more than...
Excellent. I think we lost you again there, Tommy. It's kind of come and gone here tonight, but thank you. Thank you so much, Tommy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, big pleasure. Tommy John, everybody, the one and only.